A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Peter Fricelli, retired ATF agent. He's the author of the new book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Drug Cartels. And we spoke with Pete about his book a couple of weeks ago, but I wanted to get him back on the show because there are a couple of other topics here of interest that I think he can shed some light on. So first, Operation Thor. This is a program that was aimed at stopping Mexican drug cartels trafficking of firearms into Mexico. Apparently, it was working pretty well. They were interdicting a lot of military arms, right? Not the stuff you find at Bass Pro and Cabela's. But all of a sudden, the Biden administration put a halt to it. We can't figure out why. Senator Chuck Grassley has been doing some digging, and Pete's going to talk about that. But also, I wanted to get Pete's thoughts on this ATF raid in Little Rock last week, where the executive director of the Little Rock Airport, Brian Malinowski, was shot and killed by ATF agents in a raid on his home. An ATF agent was wounded, apparently shot in the foot. It is unclear at this point whether Malinowski shot the agent or whether the agent perhaps shot himself. But Malinowski was under investigation for being engaged in the business of selling firearms without a license. That's it, right? There were no allegations of violence against Malinowski. His family wonders why the ATF decided to conduct the search warrant at 6 o'clock last Tuesday morning rather than wait for Malinowski to leave his home, go to work at the Little Rock Airport, maybe stop him as he's on his way to work, maybe stop him and take him into custody when he's at his job. But they are concerned that maybe Malinowski thought this was a group of home invaders that was targeting his home, and that's why he armed himself when the ATF agents were headed through the door. Again, there are a lot of questions surrounding how this raid was conducted, why the raid was conducted the way it was. And obviously with the ATF, you know, promulgating this rule about who is engaged in the business, trying to expand that to basically almost everybody who offers a firearm for sale. Of course, one of the concerns that many gun owners have is that this could happen to them in the future. So two big topics of conversation in our conversation with Peter Fricelli. Let's take a look and a listen. Get started with it right now. Pete, thanks so much for coming back on the program. It's good to see you again.
Always good to see you, my friend. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I saw this news out of Grassley's office last week, and I thought, all right, I wonder if Pete might be able to give us a little bit more information. And as it turns out, I think that you can. So let's start, first of all, what is or was Operation Thor?
Operation Thor was a case that was started up. It's kind of a program that was started up in the United States to track Mexico-bound firearms trafficking. It wasn't like Fast and Furious where they allowed guns to walk. I want to put that up front, you know, because it's important to know. So they had a number of successful prosecutions. And recently that program became defunded. And I happen to know about it, actually, because I was contacted by Senator Grassley's office a few months ago. And ironically, you know, many of the folks who were involved in the Fast and Furious investigation that worked in his office have moved on to other things. A lot of them are doing whistleblower protection stuff on the outside. They have a not-for-profit called Empower Oversight right now, for example, that's representing the IRS whistleblowers. Very important stuff. So they wanted to know the history, like what had happened in the past, because they wanted to compare past failures into what's happening with Operation Thor and why it was defunded. So I sat down with them some time ago and explained what happened back then. Now, they didn't obviously tell me everything that's going on in their investigation, because that's not how it works. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be focused on why that program got defunded, how the cartels are securing weapons, which still involves a degree of straw purchasing here in the United States, involved, you know, where folks are trafficking those straw purchase weapons south. But obviously, they're also looking at the other ways that the cartels are acquiring weapons. But in full disclosure, I actually think that this goes a little deeper than just ATF, because in reading between the lines, I got the impression that they were also looking at some of the decisions made by State Department, possibly as high up as the ambassador of Mexico. I know they have whistleblowers who came forward. I do know who one of them is. He had a very important position in ATF outside of the United States. And there are some other folks who are talking to them who were agents who were involved in Operation Thor, who thought it was inappropriate that the program became defunded because it was somewhat successful. So it's going to be interesting to see exactly why this happened. But look, the most important thing, the taxpayers deserve to know how their government's doing its business. And the old saying that sunlight is the best antiseptic, I think is important. But I think there's a lot more coming in this particular investigation by Grassley's office.
You know, and it's interesting that you bring up the State Department, because you know, one of the concerns that I have, and I don't know if you've seen the reports, ProPublica had a big series maybe a couple of months ago. New York Times picked up on this about 3 weeks or so ago, talking about the investigations into the Mexican president, Obrador, before he was the president of Mexico. So back in 2006, when he was running for president, apparently there were allegations that his campaign was tied to the cartels. In 2010, I think it was, the DEA busted one of his former staffers who basically ratted Obrador out and said, oh, yeah, he was taking cartel money. And so there was an attempt maybe even to do a sting operation where they were going to give millions of dollars to the Obrador campaign or Obrador staffers, allegedly coming from cartels. And the Obama administration put a stop to that investigation. Then apparently there was another investigation that started during the Trump administration that the Biden administration put a stop to. Again, looking at Obrador's alleged cartel ties. This is a guy, of course, who's blamed U.S. gun makers for the cartel violence in Mexico, right? He's got a $10 billion lawsuit filed against most of the major gun makers, with the exception of SIG, who has a pretty big contract with the Mexican military, I might add. They're not included in that lawsuit for some reason. So there's a big part of me, Pete, that wonders, did the Biden administration put a stop to this either at the request of the Mexican government or because they wanted to appease the Obrador administration? And maybe they're worried about where this investigation, maybe Obrador is worried about where this investigation would go, right? Because part of Operation Thor was investigating how military weapons were getting in the hands of the cartels. And that very well could have involved not only trafficking, you know, from the United States into Mexico, but legitimate military sales to the Mexican government that were then diverted into the hands of the cartels.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, first, it's not a secret that Obrador is alleged to have some ties to the Sinaloa cartel. In fact, very recently, his brother was disputing those ties while sitting in a place that's a hotbed for Sinaloa cartel activity, which is Mazatlan, which was a resort back in the day, which now is not a safe place to go because the cartel has really a tremendous footprint there. But no, I agree with you 100%. Look, I've said this very publicly. I have a big problem with this Mexico lawsuit because I know a few things. Number one is I know that in Fast and Furious, there were members of industry who did not want to sell to people who were trafficking guns to Mexico, who were told specifically to do so by federal prosecutors and by ATF agents, to include senior executive service level ATF personnel. So that's a problem, that now you're all of a sudden going to allow this lawsuit to go through when you had the government telling many of these folks to do exactly what they didn't want to do anymore, because they were good citizens. They didn't want to see this carnage happening on the other side of the border. That's a problem. But no, look, I do believe that there are some things that we need to be careful of when it comes to Mexico. I don't think that our government wants to take a hard stand against Obrador. I mean, and look, you see it even now with what's going on at the border. I mean, look, the president has the authority to enforce existing law. And rather than do that, what they do is they turn around and say, well, we need Congress to act. Well, if you don't like the law that's on the books now, that doesn't give you an excuse not to enforce it just because you want different laws from Congress when we have the things that are happening there. And we all saw what happened in El Paso with that. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it other than an assault on our military at the border. If that's not, a problem, then I don't know what they will potentially view as a problem. It's pretty glaring there. So, but yeah, I do think there's a possibility that some of these investigations were thwarted because we've taken this soft stance on the cartels and on Obrador because we don't want to offend our neighbor to the south. But that's not in the best interest of our country, I believe.
No, absolutely not. I would say, honestly, it's not in the best interest of the people of Mexico who are living under the cartel thumb either. I have friends who we made in Northern Virginia who were here in this country legally, went back home. He had a white collar job. He went back home to renew his visa. He was denied for whatever reason. He and his family were told, nope, you can't come back to the United States. We've stayed in touch with them in the years since. And it's heartbreaking, you know, to see how they're living the worry that they have for their children getting involved in cartel activity or becoming the victims of cartels because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, there are that's the thing. The cartel carnage that you talk about is being inflicted both north and south of the border. Right here, we get the drug deaths. We don't have as much of the cartel violence, thankfully, but in Mexico, where the cartels are, you know, killing each other, waging war over control of the country. You know, you've got a country with one gun store and a homicide rate, what, five times that of the United States? I mean, it is, it's absolutely horrifying.
Well, not just that, their clearance rate of solving homicides is next to nothing. I mean, so, I mean, the policing down there is a failure. In fact, we were even told back when I was, and again, I haven't worked the border for a number of years, we were told by people who we trusted in Mexican law enforcement, who were usually federal, not to trust state and municipal police down there, because we were told, hey, they are the uniformed enforcement arm of whichever cartel controls that territory that they're working in. And, you know, to some degree, I don't want to say you can't blame them, but I mean, look, if you push back against the cartel, because Mexico is, let's not sugarcoat things. Right now, it's a failed narco state. So if you're some honest cop and you think you're going to take a stand, you'll very quickly wind up dead. But to your point, I have people that I dealt with down there, and we have family friends who are from there. And one of them is a mechanic. And his mechanic shop has been told, you are now cartel mechanics. You will fix our cars free of charge when we need you to service our cars. So, I mean, aside from the narcotics trafficking, they're dabbling in tobacco trafficking now. The CJNG cartel and the Sinaloas estimatedly each made about $4 billion in tobacco trafficking. Imagine that, which is like a hobby for them. But, I mean, there's extortion, there's human trafficking. It's unbelievable what's happening down there. But it's even more unbelievable to me when we love to say we're a nation of laws, right, that doesn't want to enforce our border laws, and where we're not taking a hard stance against this carnage that's happening at our doorstep. And to your point, you're absolutely correct. There are many, many good, decent people in Mexico that just want to raise families and live in peace who can't, because the Mexican government has taken this soft, you know, what do they say, hug-a-thug approach to the cartels. And I believe largely because the politicians down here are profiting from the cartel's business. Let's not kid ourselves. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. They're global conglomerates now, many of them, these cartels, right, with footprints on every continent, perhaps even Antarctica at this time. But I know for a fact, every other continent. So, I mean, how far out of control do we let it get before we start, you know, doing what we can do? And again, I know we can't say a military incursion on Mexico. I'm not saying that. But there are things we've done to other countries, to include Colombia, to help get things straight, that we've not even begun to do in Mexico.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Obrador, he's got his hugs, not bullets strategy that seems to be working out oh so well there south of the border. Now, speaking of carnage on doorsteps, I want to also ask you about something that happened last week in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I know that, again, you're not active ATF, but I'm just curious. You know, the family of Brian Malinowski put out a press statement. This was the individual who was under investigation for essentially being engaged in the business of selling firearms without a license. According to an affidavit that was filed, it's estimated to have purchased and resold about 150 firearms over a roughly year-long period of time. So they get a search warrant. They go to execute that search warrant, 6 a.m. last Tuesday it was. There's a shootout of some kind. Malinowski is allegedly fires some shots. He is shot and eventually dies from his injuries 2 days later. The family want to know why on earth there was this, you know, armed raid at 6 o'clock in the morning rather than taking him into custody at his job. He's the executive director of the Little Rock Airport, maybe, you know, stopping his car on the way to work. But they've raised concerns that maybe he thought this was a home invasion, which is why, you know, he armed himself and fired shots maybe at the ATF agents outside. I'm curious, Pete. I realize you probably haven't had access to all of the internal reports or documents, but based on what you've read, do you have concerns about how this was handled?
You know, Cam, I try to be a straight shooter on this thing, and one of the things I always try not to do is to Monday morning quarterback law enforcement operations. So sure. I'm going to give you my honest opinion on this. But again, I don't know everything. And what I will say is they are keeping this somewhat close hold because it's an active investigation. So there's a few things I want to point out. Number one is when ATF agents are involved in shootings, fatal or non-fatal, they're actually not investigated internally by ATF. Now, ATF has a force review branch that will look at it. Was it an appropriate use of force for internal discipline purposes and for training purposes? But ATF-involved shootings, unlike FBI-involved shootings, are actually investigated by the municipality or the county where it happens. For example, when I was a group supervisor in Phoenix, during one of our operations, we had a fatal shooting. That shooting was investigated by the Phoenix Police Homicide Squad and the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. So that's important. So, I mean, they are going to investigate this. And if people need to be held accountable, then that should happen. Now, why they went there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I share some of those concerns, because here's a guy who worked at an airport, which is a pretty sterile environment. So they could have, and again, I don't know, you know, why they decided to hit this at 6 o'clock in the morning. There could have been external factors that neither of us are aware of. So I want to be cautious and put that on the table. Like maybe the prosecutors wanted for some reason for them to get into that house at that time, or maybe there was some other considerations, destruction of evidence. So again, this needs to be investigated. But I mean, barring that, they could have had a local police officer stop them on the way to work, walk up on the car. Hey, we have a warrant. Go back to the house, search the house. They could have gone to his employment. Again, the airport's a very sterile environment, and approached him there. They said, sir, we have a warrant for your residence. Come with us, go back and search the residence. So why that happened where they went there at 6 o'clock in the morning, I don't know. I do know that a lot of law enforcement entities have gone to this new, it's not really new, a technique called surround and call out, where they'll knock on the door and then back off and call everybody out and then serve the warrant and then go inside and execute that search. You know, why that wasn't done, I don't know. But I do agree. At 6 o'clock in the morning, you're startled, you wake up in your sleep, right? Someone's knocking on the door. Maybe they didn't clearly say police. Again, I don't know, I wasn't there. Could there have been shots fired because this person thought he was being home invaded? Absolutely. And I think that's why a lot of police departments don't do dynamic entries anymore in these sort of situations. So that's a concern. And I know an ATF agent was shot. My understanding is he was shot in the foot. So was he shot by Mr. Malinowski, or did he, when he heard gunshots go off, did he have his finger where it shouldn't have been, which on the trigger and get startled, shoot himself in the foot? These are all things that I don't know. But right. It's an interesting case because, look, Mr. Malinowski had a pretty prominent job in government that required a background check. So it's a little bit interesting, you know, this whole case in its totality is not what you normally see in ATF. And look, I'll be completely honest and, you know, and say that I, as an agent, did not do a lot of engaged in the business cases. I mostly focused on gang cases. And even within, you know, my time as a supervisor, a lot of my agents didn't do too many of these cases because we had limited resources and we found it easier to go after people who were, you know, violent in nature and misusing guns rather than, you know, look, the average, you know, engaged in a business case is a middle-aged guy who's selling guns to supplement his income, usually to other middle-aged guys. In this particular case, you know, not who weren't criminals. In this particular case, my understanding is some of the guns that Malinowski purchased showed up in the hands of gang members in Northern California. And somehow there was also some involvement with Canadian law enforcement. I'm not sure if it's the Ontario Provincial Police's Weapons Enforcement Unit or the RCMP has this National Weapons Enforcement Support Team. I'm not sure which of those two entities was involved. So, I mean, there's still a lot that needs to be, I guess, you know, unearthed as this investigation goes on.
Yeah, no, there is. And that's the thing. I mean, we have, I think, more questions than answers at this point, and hopefully we'll get some of those answers. But, you know, one of the other concerns that I have, Pete, is the ATF is right now promulgating this rule, expanding who is engaged in the business, right? To the point that you don't even have to complete a transaction. If you simply offer a firearm for sale under this proposed rule, that might be enough to trigger an ATF investigation. I have to say, and I don't think I'm wearing, I mean, there's no tinfoil inside my hat, but, you know, I'm really concerned that if you expand this universe, and Joe Biden has said himself that he wants this to bring us as close as possible without a vote in Congress to universal background checks. So the idea is that, you know, again, if you're selling a firearm, even if it's to a neighbor, if it's a private sale, you know, the federal government wants you to put that buyer through a background check. Or again, they might say, well, you know what, you should have had an FFL yourself. We're going to prosecute you, charge you with a federal felony, send you to prison because we think you should. You were engaged in the business. So I'm concerned that with this expansion, this dramatic expansion of who is engaged in the business of selling firearms, that incidents like this could become more common in the future.
Yeah, but I'll tell you this, I am as well, and I've been vocal about that. Like, I don't like where this ATF director is going, frankly. A lot of it's targeting the industry, inappropriately, I would say. I do believe a lot of it is, well, I know for a fact, a lot of his direction is actually coming out of the White House. It's coming out of the Office of the Guns Czar, which is, you know, something that was created under the Biden administration. And Kamala Harris, who's also the border czar, is the gun czar, by the way. But my understanding is she's completely hands-off. And this is actually being driven by Rob Wilcox, who's formerly of Everytown, a Bloomberg guy, who is anti-gun. So that's troubling to me. But I'll tell you this, it's also troubling to the rank and file in ATF who do not want to be going out there and doing this. They want to go after violent criminals, which was what ATF was good at, and not chasing down these rulings. There are some other things that I've heard. For example, I had heard that at one point they were even considering coming out with some sort of a ruling that any entity that deals with the U.S. government selling contracts to government entities would be barred from selling to civilians. So in other words, if Glock was going to sell guns to FBI, that they would be prohibited from selling guns to the general public. I don't think that's going anywhere, but these are the kind of things that are being chopped around, like brainstormed at in headquarters right now. And I think it's inappropriate. Look, I find it appalling when we try to find new things to go out there and go after, right? When we want to find new laws that are being regulated rather than legislated, when you have, situations like what I documented in my book that we already discussed, I don't go back into the book, where you have glaring violations of situations where people are trafficking guns to killers, and we're not prosecuting those cases. With the limited resources that ATF has, they should focus on going after people who are shooting other people in, wherever part of the country we have these shooting problems, and back off going after people who are just enjoying their Second Amendment privileges, or possibly want to sell a firearm to a neighbor that they know is of good character, who isn't a criminal, who isn't out there doing bad things that maybe they go shooting with or something like that. It's just very troublesome.
It is very troublesome. Second Amendment rights, by the way, not privileges. Got to be clear.
Yes, sir. My apologies.
It's all right. There's a portion of my audience that's starting to be like, Cam, are you talking to somebody who used to work at the ATF? So I want to make sure that, we get that straight too. And listen, I appreciate your straight shooting, Pete. I really do, because, it's good to know that there aren't just people on the outside who are bothered by what they see going on with the ATF, that there are people who worked in the agency, who still work in the agency, according to you, who are just as bothered. I got to ask, we've seen in a lot of law enforcement agencies around the country, particularly going back to 2020, the number of retirements is way up. There are staffing problems. Are you seeing colleagues say, enough's enough, I'm out, I can't do this anymore?
Well, look, I'm glad you bring this up, because there's actually a few different facets to this. One of the problems is a lot of folks are leaving because of, the tone. Like, look, I left when I heard a speech that Merrick Garland gave at ATF headquarters that I just was not in, I didn't believe in it. Like, it seemed like he was more focused, again, like we spoke of earlier, on the gun than of the criminal. So I was like, something, my values and his values aren't exactly in alignment. I was eligible to retire. I left. I do believe some people are doing that. One of the problems we have now is you have a lot of young, inexperienced people promoting into supervisory positions in ATF. And I partially blame what happened in Fast and Furious to that. Because if you had a seasoned special agent in charge running the Phoenix Field Division, he would have called BS on what was happening there and just said, hey, we're not doing that. And regardless of whether pressure was coming from above or something spinning up from below, he would have known better. That's not the case anymore. We have a lot of very young people who are promoting who don't have that experience to draw from. And with experience comes, I think, some degree of the ability to stand up for yourself, too. So I that concerns me. The other thing that concerns me, frankly, is, and touches on what we were talking about earlier, is a lot of people came to ATF from homicide squads, from robbery squads, from local police departments, from other federal agencies, because they believed in the mission of going after violent criminals. I mean, and look, I take great pride in having done that. Murderers, I put murderers away, home invaders. I didn't go after people for low-level stuff, unless it was to go after a person who I know was a really bad criminal, to flip them to go after the bigger criminals. But it wasn't like just to take stats, to go after somebody just to get a number. And most ATF agents don't do that. So you have a retention problem for the first time in my knowledge of over 20 plus years working with ATF as an agent, as an executive, but even as a local cop. I worked with them quite a bit when I was a homicide detective in New York. So as these people who came here for the right reason leave, you wonder who backfills them, right? So is it the people who don't necessarily believe in the Second Amendment, who believe in the right to bear arms, not the privilege, but the right? Is it people who decide, something, I don't like guns, so I just want to punish people who possess or as opposed to the people who are out there hurting other people? So that's something that concerns me as well, is that, that's why we should be apolitical. ATF should not be political, should not be regulating rather than enforcing existing law, because it's just the nature of the work that we do is such a hotbed issue to begin with that it needs to be pure. So when I see these things happen, it offends me. I don't know how else to put it, but it offends me.
Well, you're not alone. I can tell you that. Listen, Pete, I appreciate you joining me on the program today. I always value your insight. It is great to get a chance to talk again and remind folks, where can they get your new book, your memoir about Operation Fast and Furious?
Well, it's out on the shelves now. And last time we spoke, it was about to be released. So it's out on the shelves now, but it can be bought on Amazon or any other bookstore, you know, websites. It's on the shelves somewhere, you know, probably near you. I don't know if every bookstore has it on every shelf. Or they can actually, you know, reach out to me on my website. It's www.peterjforselli.com. No, you know, just one word, Peter J. Forselli. But yeah, I think folks need to know what happened there because it should never, ever be allowed to happen again.
Yeah, absolutely right. Pete, thank you so much, sir. I look forward to doing this again very soon, but I really do appreciate you joining me today.
Anytime. I appreciate you straight shooting. Take care, Ken.
You too. I appreciate Pete's time. And really, if you have not read his new book, The Deadly Path, How Operation Fast and Furious and Bad Lawyers Armed Mexican Cartels, do yourself a favor. Pick it up. It is engrossing. It is infuriating. It will leave you with more questions. I would say it helps to have a basic understanding of Operation Fast and Furious before you sit down and read the book. But as I said when we had Pete on the last time, I started the book. I cracked it open. I read maybe a chapter or two before I had to get to work. And then when I got done with work that day, I just sat and I read the rest of that book. I polished it off that same night because I couldn't put it down. And I'm taking notes as I'm reading this. I'm like, I got to ask Pete about this. Oh, my gosh, I got to, you know, copy this section of the book. It is engrossing. It is a page turner, but it is also infuriating because, again, we still don't have some of the basic answers about how Fast and Furious came to be. And there were very few consequences for the architects. In fact, in some cases, no consequences whatsoever for the architects of Operation Fast and Furious. All right, now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story out of San Francisco where there is outrage over a probationary sentence for a man who assaulted a 94-year-old woman. She was stabbed. This wasn't, you know, even a case of, well, she got pushed, somebody bumped against her as you're walking down the road. No. Ann Taylor, 94 years old, stabbed in 2021. Drew headlines, right? It was part of a wave of unprovoked attacks on the Asian American community, particularly in the Bay Area. The suspect in this case, 35-year-old Daniel Couch, pleaded guilty to the assault charge and was sentenced to probation. According to NBC in San Francisco, the sentence cannot be imposed until both parties sign an agreement as to the details of the sentence. And Brooke Jenkins, the DA in San Francisco, sounds like may not sign on, saying, when we see our seniors being violently attacked and there are no actual consequences for it, yes, we are going to come together and we are going to stand together against what is happening. Taylor survived the attack in front of her apartment, but again, not without injuries. And on Friday, you had San Francisco residents, including some politicians who very recently, you know, have taken a very soft on crime approach, who are now advocating for a new sentence against this suspect. There were also those who came out in defense, not necessarily of the attacker, but in defense of the Senate, saying that this is a case has become politicized. According to the DA's office, the plea made an open court. They do object to it. The attorney for Couch, Lisa Dewberry, on the other hand, applauded the judge for taking his mental state at the time of the attack into consideration. She also said she appreciated the sentence that the judge imposed, especially the intensive supervision provision, which would supposedly provide treatment for mental health, substance abuse, as well as ankle monitoring. Now, again, we've talked before about the worthlessness of these ankle monitors. What happens when somebody breaks their ankle monitor, cuts it off? Is an all-points bulletin sent out? No. No. Oftentimes, nobody's even told. And when somebody is told, it's, put out a warrant. If we catch them, I guess there's another charge that we can bring them in on. But the actual probationary sentence for stabbing someone. Look, if the suspect in this case was not in the right mind, if they are mentally ill, okay, then maybe the adjudication or the judgment should involve some time in a mental health facility, inpatient treatment, right? But that's not the case here. This is simply probation. So his attorney can talk about her client's mental state at the time, but according to the courts, he was in his right mind. He did know the difference between right and wrong. And in that case, again, he stabbed a nonagenarian and is getting away with a slap on the wrist. At least, again, if the DA does not object to the sentence here. Today's armed citizen story from Albuquerque, New Mexico, where a burglary suspect shot by a homeowner, already wanted by police, by the way, at the time. This is kind of a crazy story. So this was last Thursday. Albuquerque police say they located a stolen vehicle driven by 32-year-old Joseph Rivera. They were able to deflate the vehicle's tires using stop sticks, but Rivera continued to drive on the rims, ultimately crashing the car in the area of Candelaria Road and Rio Grande Boulevard. He then got out of the car and fled on foot. About 5 minutes later, there's a 911 call coming into police where the caller was telling dispatch there was a man inside her home who had broken in. Caller gave a description that matched Rivera. Police say Rivera demanded that the homeowner give him her car keys. He then took the keys. The homeowner locked the front door behind Rivera after he left. Then she went into her bedroom. She grabbed her gun, because I guess she didn't have the time to access it when Rivera broke into her home. You know, at that point, you might think, all right, well, he's already gone, right? No, he came back. According to authorities, Rivera then returned to the home demanding more keys. Somehow was able to get in, even though she had locked the front door. Don't know if he burst through a window or stuck in the back. Don't know. But somehow he once again gained entry to the house and demanded more keys from the homeowner. She told him to leave. He refused. And that is when she shot Rivera. According to authorities, she actually tended to his wound until officers arrived. Rivera taken to a local hospital. After he is released, he is expected to be taken into custody. The woman, obviously, not expected to face any charges at all, and will probably be completely ignored by the governor as well, since this is an example of an armed citizen using their Second Amendment rights to protect themselves. And, of course, the governor insists that, you know, that never happens. Law-abiding gun owners are the problem in New Mexico, which is why she's tried to ban concealed carry. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A personal trainer in Chicago who came to the aid of a stranger on a city street, a business owner who had a heart attack, and the good Samaritan who saved him. This from a Block Club Chicago, describing the events that led again to this life-saving effort. Tyler McCall was on his way to work. He runs a stationery shop. And as he's walking down the street, getting ready to open up paper and pencil, he just dropped. On the other side of the street, there was a guy named Dan Ward. He saw McCall fall to the ground, heard him yell out in pain. Ward immediately ran across the street, called 911, and then started performing CPR. You can see there's Ward on the left, McCall on the right. Ward says they talk about emergencies feeling like they last forever, but it was the weirdest thing. It felt so fast. He said, once I knelt by Tyler, I saw him gasping and trying to breathe, and then I heard the sirens, and I just kept talking to him, saying, hey, they're on their way. They're on their way. Chicago Fire arrived within a couple of minutes. They took over. First responders continued to perform CPR on McCall before he was taken away in an ambulance. Ward stayed by McCall's side the entire time. He said, I didn't save his life. The paramedic saved his life. I don't think I did anything special. I kept wondering, like, where's Batman when you need him? Well, listen, first of all, calling 911 may very well have saved his life. Performing CPR until paramedics were able to arrive on scene also may very well have saved his life. So, Dan, you may not think of yourself as a Cape Crusader, but, I mean, you are kind of a superhero, at least in that Chicago city block. The good news is that McCall has left the hospital 5 days recovering. He is now awaiting surgery, however, to hopefully repair an underlying cardiac condition. He says the neighborhood's been incredible since everything happened. I haven't had to buy dinner in weeks. Food just keeps showing up. People have been stopping by the shop, asking about me, offering to help, bringing flowers and cards. He says, I feel surrounded by the community's love. Ward, meanwhile, didn't realize that McCall had survived. after he was taken away in the ambulance, he continued on about his day, went to work as a personal trainer. And then a couple of days later, somebody sent him a post that McCall had made in a Facebook group, hoping to find, quote, whoever saved his life. And Ward said that he is so grateful that he was in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. He said, my heart felt so heavy the day that McCall had that heart attack. He said, I went back to work. He said, it was so quiet. It's just not like me at all. He said, when I finally saw McCall's message later, he said, it felt like I floated the rest of the day. So again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need, which is not something that happens as often as you'd like to see it in Chicago. Dan Ward, we thank you for your very, very good deed. Now, that is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to being back with you again tomorrow for our 2A Tuesday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, legislation, litigation, regulation, armed citizen stories, and more. It's all there at BearingArms.com. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member as well. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get a significant savings on your VIP or VIP Gold membership. We're going to give you exclusive content you won't find anywhere else. Your support really does matter. It truly does make a difference. So thank you again. See you back here tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the rest of your Monday. It's as well as a Monday can be enjoyed. Be well. Be safe. And be free.